This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
We're all about jobs today, who's working, who isn't, and while we're at it, how well are the Fed's tools working? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, April 7th. Good to have you along. The big monthly jobs report came out this morning, and the employment picture for March looked pretty much like what we were expecting. The Labor Department said non-farm payrolls, a.k.a. jobs, grew by 236,000 last month, knocking the unemployment rate down just a bit to 3.5%. But, of course, there's lots to glean from this report about what's really happening in this economy. And to help with that, I'm joined by Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post and Kate Davidson at Bloomberg. Hey, you two. So, Kate, let's start with you first. With unemployment so low and having been low for a while, who's still left on the, you know, sidelines of the labor market? Oh, we may have lost her. Catherine, you want to take a stab at it?
Sure. Happy to do so. So labor force participation rates have pretty much recovered once you adjust for age. There was actually an interesting paper from the New York Fed recently looking at this. There were a lot of retirements, but among working age people, we're basically back to the participation rates that we had before. So there isn't a giant hidden pool of labor waiting on the sidelines right now. And unless you have a surge of immigration, which I think seems unlikely given our political fights over immigration, this also suggests that there's not going to be suddenly a new pool of available workers to fill these high levels of job openings that we've still seen. So, you know, unless all those retirees get lured back into the labor market, I think it's pretty unlikely that they're going to be a lot more workers to be asking for jobs.
All right. So then are there downsides to having unemployment this low for this long?
Well, it's a little counterintuitive. Who doesn't want more jobs? Who doesn't want lower joblessness? The problem right now is that the number of vacancies, the number of available job openings vastly exceeds the pool of available unemployed workers. You know, I feel like the flip response whenever employers complain about worker shortages is, why don't you just raise wages? And in fact, they have raised wages, at least in nominal terms. But raising wages alone is not going to fix that mismatch between the number of openings and the number of workers that there are. Because, again, there are many more openings than there are workers.
Right.
And unless those wage increases are so generous that we're, you know, getting 75-year-olds to come back off the sidelines and leave you know, their retirement plans, or their retirement homes in Florida or wherever. I think it's just not going to happen, which is why you see the Fed deciding that, well, if we can't affect the supply side of things, whether that mm-hmm. means the supply of labor or otherwise, maybe we can affect the demand side of things, which is, you know, a much less pleasant way to resolve that supply-demand mismatch. But that's the strategy, right? That they're raising right. interest rates to cool demand, and mm-hmm. that includes demand for workers.
Right. I think we've got Kate back on the phone. And Kate, I'll ask you, you know, it's been so hard to predict what's going on in the labor market, you know, since the pandemic started. Why do you think this report was pretty much in line with expectations?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that things are to some extent starting to normalize, although it was really only a month ago that we had a really, really surprising jobs report in January, right? Or I guess 2 months ago, where we saw these big seasonal factors that had distorted things. And that was still a little bit of that pandemic hangover. So I think it's just that with time, the factors that the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses to try and figure these things out and the adjustments that they make are starting to reflect kind of the, you don't want to say post-pandemic reality, because I think, you know, there are many people consider we're still somewhat, you know, living in the pandemic. I mean, people, COVID is still with us, and there are still the after effects of that, but a lot more people back to work, a lot more kind of normal hiring patterns. And so I think that is hopefully making economists' jobs a little bit easier when it comes to forecasting and estimating what these numbers are going to look like each month.
Kate, sticking with you, you know, we got JOLTS numbers, job openings and labor turnover survey, first time claims for unemployment this week that seem to indicate maybe a little bit of a cooling of the labor market. I mean, dare we utter the words soft landing at this point?
At your own risk, right, Kimberly? I mean, I think that the story has shifted a number of times, and there have been so many different wrinkles. This has been a recovery or an expansion unlike any other, right? And this is just another wrinkle that it turns out, hey, maybe the labor market wasn't quite as hot as we thought after we saw some recent revisions made to the data, the jobless claims data. But as far as what that means for soft landing, I don't know. I mean, I think that with the recent turmoil in the banking sector, it's going to take a while to see how that kind of filters through the rest of the economy. So, right, labor market, we learned again this week, is still pretty resilient. Demand is still pretty healthy, as Catherine, of course, was saying. And yet interest rates are very high. They've gone up very rapidly. And so we're starting to, you know, we've seen that kind of the effects of that in certain sectors. Will things continue to come down slowly? Maybe that would be nice. The Fed would love that. But I think that things have been kind of, you know, a lot of new uncertainty has kind of come back into the picture with the banking crisis.
Catherine, if this report is kind of, you know, boring in that it was in line with expectations, I mean, does the Fed just sort of walk on by and focus on other data like future inflation data? We've got CPI coming out next week.
Well, absolutely, they're going to be paying attention to the inflation numbers. I think that there are some nuggets in this report that the Fed would be paying, that I expect the Fed is paying attention to, including mm-hmm. the fact that nominal wage growth slowed down, including the fact that the construction sector lost jobs, which I point out because the part of the economy that is among the most sensitive to rising interest rates is housing. And so maybe there's a clue there, if you see the construction sector shrinking in terms of the number of people employed, that those interest rate hikes are having an effect, you know, which is part of the reason why, like the fact that we've been talking, you mentioned before that forecasts have been off month after month after mm-hmm. month, that this one was more on target. They've been off pretty much always in the same direction, in that they were always forecasting a slowdown, and instead the numbers kept beating expectations. So that's partly maybe because the housing industry had been holding up so well, and maybe it won't be. So I think all of those things matter, but yeah, absolutely, the thing that the Fed is most worried about is inflation. And until we get those new numbers, we won't know exactly what they plan to do at their next meeting.
Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post, Kate Davidson at Bloomberg. Thank you, too.
Thanks,
Kimberly.
The markets were closed today in observance of Good Friday, so we'll have some other details when we do the numbers. Now let's take a moment here to remember that the reason the Fed has been raising interest rates lately is to cool the economy, as people say. Over the past year, the Fed has raised the federal funds target rate from basically zero to around 5%, like we were just talking about. And historically, that is a really big, really fast increase. But that unemployment rate we got today, 3.5%, is still historically low. So all that talk about monetary policy being a blunt tool, well, maybe that tool is also kind of dull. Marketplace's Matt Levin has this one.
If in 2019 you would have told Fitch Ratings economist Olu Sonola that the Fed would have raised rates this high this quickly?
I will think the unemployment rate would have increased by at least 1.5%.
Here's the basic Econ 101 logic. The Fed raises the cost of borrowing, consumers spend less, companies can't finance payroll as easily, the economy slows, and whammo, fewer jobs. But if by later this year the labor market is still this tight, Sonola will start questioning whether COVID has done to macroeconomic theory what it did to, say, downtown office buildings.
What the pandemic has done is introduce a number of variables and elements into the equation that the people that wrote macroeconomics textbooks just didn't think about.
Most econ textbooks don't have chapters on revenge travel or boomer retirements or long COVID, which have kept labor demand higher and supply scarcer. Anil Kashyap is a professor at the University of Chicago's Business School. He says part of this is just delayed pain. Lots of companies are still paying workers with the help of low interest loans they took out before rates spiked.
There's a bunch of businesses that have loans and bonds that were about zero that are going to need to refinance. When they do, they're going to face a much higher cost of capital.
So that's one example of that famous long and variable lag. And speaking of Fed cliches, calling interest rates a blunt tool for the economy might not be the best metaphor. Economist Preston Bui at Employ America says they're more like a steamroller.
So the steamroller works well if you're trying to compact gravel or flatten concrete. But if there are large rocks in the way, for example, the steamroller is not going to work that well there.
I like that analogy, especially because if you've been laid off, you might feel like you've been run over. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Like we were talking about at the top of the show, we pretty much have a sense of what's going on with unemployment these days. So one thing people are watching is labor force participation. And one group seeing a steady rise in that category is teens. In March, 37.4% of Americans aged 16 to 19 were actively employed or looking for work, according to the Labor Department. That's up substantially from pre-pandemic levels, thanks in part to higher starting wages in the service industry. But it's a different story for slightly older members of Gen Z. Labor participation rates in the 20 to 24 age bracket are still lagging. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more on what's behind this divide in the Zoomer workforce.
Teenagers are not the easiest people to reach on a weekday morning. So I called up someone who hires a lot of them.
In fact, we employ more teens today than I can remember ever having employed.
Mason Ayer owns Kirby Lane Cafe, an Austin-based comfort food chain. Before the pandemic, he says high school-aged kids were really only competitive for hostess and dishwasher jobs. But thanks to the tight labor market,
there's opportunities for teens to come and wait tables at our restaurants and make upwards of $20, $25 an hour.
Higher starting wages have helped reverse a long-standing trend of declining teen workforce participation, says Ron Hetrick, a senior labor economist with Lightcast. Take his 19-year-old son. Last summer, he got a job at a local pool snack bar.
Made an absolute killing.
As for the older Zoomers on the sidelines of the labor market, Hetrick has a hunch about what's going on there, too.
The 20-24-year-olds were the bullseye of the COVID years. They would have been starting out freshmen, sophomore, you know, juniors in college.
Because of that disruption, he says some of them put their higher education on hold. Others are slowing down or spacing out their college years, like his older kid.
She was like, I was robbed. Like, I didn't get as much on campus time. So she purposely kind of sandbagged the credits to stretch it out.
Another feature of becoming an adult during a pandemic.
There seems to be less desire to just compromise.
When it comes to job searches, Nicole Smith, chief economist with Georgetown's Center on Education and the Workforce, says Zoomers are coming of age while workplace norms are changing.
There's a lot more thinking about job flexibility and thinking about work-life balance.
They're more likely to hold out rather than say yes to their first real job offer. But if we see significant cooling in the labor market, Smith says those workers won't be able to be choosy. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we just like lost our shorts in December.
But you gotta root for the underdog. First, though, let's do the numbers. Markets here and in Europe were closed today in observance of Good Friday. For the week, the Dow added 0.6%, the Nasdaq lost 1.1%, and the S&P 500 shed 0.1%. For all the Easter, Passover, and Ramadan travelers this weekend, AAA reports that on average, a gallon of regular will run you $3.58. That's 57 cents cheaper than a year ago. A bright spot in today's jobs report, the unemployment rate for Black Americans fell to 5% in March. That's the lowest rate since the government started tracking this in 1972. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. To health news now, specifically kids' health. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is currently accepting comments on proposed changes to school lunches, many of which are paid for with federal funds. Some of the potential changes include limiting the amount of sodium, added sugar, and prioritizing whole grains in kids' meals. None of the new rules would take effect until fall 2024, but there's already pushback. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports from Maryland that the stakes are high, both nutritionally and financially.
There are some eye rolls from eighth graders at Margaret Brent Middle School in rural St. Mary's County at the side dish cafeteria worker Chenmay Fletcher offers to go with pepperoni pizza.
How about sweet potato?
No, thank you.
She even switches to Mandarin to convince one student, telling him, yeah, they're sweet. Current USDA rules from 2012 say students must take at least one fruit or vegetable, so schools have to buy and offer them. Kids here who don't accept sweet potatoes today have to choose something else, such as dried chickpeas or a side salad, which one eighth grader opts for, along with
an apple juice because the milk is mid.
Mid is eighth grade speak for not good. The salad and the apple juice count towards the current vegetable and fruit requirements. Apple juice counts as half a serving of fruit. And more fresh food would help with the proposed USDA regulations to cut sodium and sugar. But Megan Doran, who directs St. Mary's Food Nutrition Services, says this district doesn't have staff or money for that.
For us, with labor, you can't do a lot of scratch cooking.
Because in the current tight job market, it's hard to hire that staff. Doran's also a member of the nonprofit School Nutrition Association. This national group for school nutrition professionals is advocating to maintain the current standards around sodium and added sugar. Doran is worried that kids won't eat the new food and will go hungry. She says that'll affect their ability to learn and their health. In addition,
if the kids aren't eating, then we have to cut labor, we have to cut costs, and, you know, that essentially would mean, you know, possibly letting some staff go, changing our menus to meet those cost standards.
Even the food manufacturers are worried and have begun estimating costs under the proposed rules. JTM Food Group sells macaroni and cheese and other products to more than 10,000 districts around the country, including St. Mary's. Brian Hoffmeyer is JTM's Vice President of Education and Governmental Sales. He says to meet the proposed sodium reduction, he'll use a blend of salt and potassium chloride called light salt. But he says there's not enough of it.
And if there's a limited supply of light salt, then the price will be 40 or 50 times what salt is as an ingredient.
Hoffmeyer also says many products made to the new standards won't taste as good. So JTM could cut back what it makes for the K-12 market, even though it represents over 40% of its business.
I'm not going to make and sell product that people don't like. I mean, I'm just not going to.
The USDA isn't worried that kids won't eat the healthier options. Cindy Long, the agency's administrator for Food and Nutrition Service, cites past experience with menu changes.
I've heard so many stories over the years about kids, you know, going home and asking their parents about, oh my gosh, we had this thing called kiwi. Can we try that?
Long also points to research that finds that kids who eat both breakfast and lunch at school get about half their calories there.
What's at stake is putting kids on a path toward a healthy life. Or not.
As of this week, the USDA has received more than 70,000 comments about the proposed standards for school meals. St. Mary's middle schoolers have something else on their minds. Bigger pizzas.
That circle one is not big enough.
Bigger the better. Like, that's just it.
Are you guys always hungry?
Yes. Yes.
The proposed USDA changes are meant to both feed those hungry kids now and also, with limited funds, change the way the next generation eats. To this end, the agency is open to more feedback. It's taking comments until May 10th. In St. Mary's County, Maryland, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Hopefully by now you're fully recovered from March Madness. And with that in the rearview mirror, we've got some numbers. Viewership for women's matches this year was way up. The Elite Eight games averaged 2.2 million viewers, 4.5 million for the Final Four, and for the final match, 9.9 million. That's a 103% viewership increase from just the year before. So where better to get in on the women's sports hype than at a bar that airs only women's sports? For the latest installment of our series, My Economy, we checked in with Ginny Nguyen in Portland, Oregon. She's the owner of The Sports Bra, where they do exactly that.
March Madness was literally madness in all of the best ways. So we had Final Four on Friday. We opened early for the Thorns game on Saturday, and then Sunday was a championship game. So it was like 3 days of just like nonstop. I feel like there's just a dramatic difference between basketball and soccer fans. So soccer, there's like whole entire like 10-minute periods where nobody's saying anything. In basketball, it is like dramatic all the time. There's like constant energy, like a static energy that's just like blah, 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 and then it's just like explosive at times. People came like in jerseys, dressed up. There were tables where couples had the opposite team's jerseys on because they came from different schools or different regions of the country. So you just had like this really amazing vibe of like a friendly rivalry. During the winter, we definitely had a couple months of just like slow, super slow. We just like lost our shorts in December. But overall, the things like steady business and stuff like that, we're very fortunate. We've just been doing really well. Supply chain stuff, I mean, there is a dramatic rise in food costs. And we're in the process of reprinting our menus now for spring, summer anyway. And we're going to accommodate for some of that. But it is dramatic. And I spoke to a restaurant owner of a large chain here in Portland. And he said that they've raised prices 5 times in the last 5 months to keep up. And because they're so large, they can do it, you know, but because we're small and there's tons of small restaurants, they literally can't afford to do that because the customers would never come back. But, you know, we've made kind of a name for ourselves. So I would say that in the grand scheme of things, the sports bra and I are very, very fortunate as far as business goes. We just celebrated our 1 year anniversary and it was really, really special. You know, spaces like this are really important for not just sports and not just representation, but for the people who come to be a part of that community. So there was a woman who came in and brought me a bouquet of flowers. And she's a regular. She comes in all the time. But the cool story is that when she came into the sports bra on our grand opening day, she met another woman at the bar. The two of them got to talking and they started dating like shortly after that. And they're still together. So when she said happy anniversary to me, I was just like, happy anniversary to you. And like, we always joke about like, if they get married, they got to get married at the sports bra.
That was Jenny Nguyen at the Sports Bra in Portland, Oregon. We can't do this series without you, so let us know what's going on in your economy at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, we're technically in the spring home buying season, but according to the Fannie Mae Home Purchase Sentiment Index, the vast majority of us still think it's a bad time to buy a home. Numbers out today show only 20% think it's a good time to buy due to a mix of concerns over interest rates, home prices, and fears about job losses, which I suppose makes this next story pretty much on brand for my millennial generation. A report out from Rent Cafe says in 2022, we finally switched from being a majority renter to a majority homeowner generation. Which, of course, is happening when people feel it's pretty much the worst time to buy a home. Here's your moment of economic context, a final bit of data from that March jobs report we've been talking about throughout the show. We often speak generally about the unemployment rate, but of course that rate is different for different groups. Usually black unemployment runs about double white unemployment, but that gap has been closing, and today we learn that in March, the gap between the unemployment rates for black and white Americans narrowed to 1.8%. That's the smallest on record. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Kimberly Adams. Have a good weekend, and we will be back on Monday.
This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.